Good morning. Big Phil. Too big to fail? Until he wasn't.
Well, I deeply regret that my trip to Ireland in recent times has caused so much upset and anger and concern to people. People have suffered a lot with the COVID-19 regulations. We've had people dying. We've had people who are worried about their families. We've had business community and society generally, you know, engaging in an upheaval because of this pandemic. And, of course, I broke no law when I went to Ireland. I broke no regulations, but I could have adhered better to the guidelines. And this was a distraction, of course, for many people at a time when they were trying to grapple with the seriousness of this pandemic. And I felt that the fact that I made these mistakes, notwithstanding the fact that I didn't break the law, was a sufficient distraction from the job that I was doing and from the work of the Commission. And I have meditated on this very seriously in the last few days. And, of course, I've come to the conclusion that I should remove this distraction, and that after almost 40 years in public life in Ireland and in Europe, I've come to the reluctant conclusion that this sort of distraction around my visit to Ireland was going to continue and continue, and therefore I should resign and take myself away from this work that's essential now for the European Union and the Member States to work together to deal with the COVID pandemic.
Morning Ireland, bringing us Tony Connolly's interview with Phil Hogan as he stepped down as EU Commissioner for Trade on Wednesday evening. And in many ways it was a tale of two Phils. There we have a chastened, contrite, perhaps even a smidgen sheepish Mr. Hogan. Contrast that with the Phil we heard just a day earlier when the tone was, well, perhaps closer to bullish. First, the apology.
No, let me be very clear. I made a mistake by going to that event. I am embarrassed about it. When I see all of the various tragedies around the country arising from COVID regulations, I know I should not have been there. I've apologised for that profusely. I think of all the people that have suffered bereavement. I think of the frontline workers. And a gathering of that nature was not appropriate in this time. There is no excuse for this.
No excuse, maybe, but there was a defence.
I was obliged to have restricted movements in the first few days, which I did. I then unexpectedly had to go to hospital for a medical intervention. My doctors tested me for COVID-19 and I was COVID-free. And I was no risk to anybody, so I was free to go, according to my medical people.
Not according to the Department of Foreign Affairs.
Yes, but no, hold on. And I didn't accept their word fully for that. I observed a website, which is the Citizens Information website, which is clear for anybody to see, that I could go anywhere I wished without being isolated because of the fact that I had a negative test in relation to COVID-19. And that is, I think most reasonable people, when you consult a website which is funded by the HSE and the state agencies, that they will see deliberately that it's there in black and white. If you do not have COVID-19 and you're tested negatively, you are not obliged to self-isolate. It's there in black and white. So are the state agencies saying that they're giving wrong information to the Citizens Information Service?
The state agencies are making a distinction between self-isolating if you have symptoms and the requirements that you are obliged to follow if you're coming in from a high-risk country. They're two distinct obligations. And RTE has checked with the Health Service Healthline today, and they've been told that even if you have a COVID test and you test negative, you are still obliged to see out the end of your 14-day restricted period.
Well, I don't accept that.
Tony Connolly's interview was heard on Drive Time on Tuesday evening, and sure, that was just the half of it. Chatting on the mobile phone, grub in the K Club, nip in for a round and a dare, and generally uphill, downdale. Not great. And lest we think this was just a local story confined to our fair isle, not so. Here's Irish Times Europe correspondent Naomi O'Leary with Mary, also on Tuesday's Drive Time.
It is the only water cooler conversation in Brussels, Commissioner Hogan.
Talk of the town in Brussels, and not in a good way. But it did have the unexpected outcome of finally bonding the government coalition, silver linings, eh? And they came out with a joint statement criticising Phil Hogan and saying his breaking of public health guidelines had undermined public confidence. Well, on Wednesday, Claire Byrne, for it is she who takes the 10 slot now, she spoke to journalist Alison O'Connor, who had heard Phil Hogan's apology, and, well, she pretty much nailed it.
I don't see Phil Hogan being asked at any time soon to contribute to any book with the title The Art of the Public Apology. You know, do you? I think he came across as big Phil, pure thick. The attitude is all Mayfane. And I too would have thought over the weekend, look, maybe we need to be pragmatic here. He has an important portfolio. We're very cross. It has done an awful lot of damage. But I think we've crossed that Rubicon now. I think you have to have your standards. We've really, if you reflect on it, and it's not over yet, it's a scandal, which unlike anything we've seen in Irish public life in terms of the anger, you just have to listen to Liveline to appreciate that for the last number of days, the huge sadness that's there, and the sense that it is just a kick in the teeth to people who, you know, have suffered so much over the last few months. But not just that. It's the enormous sense of solidarity that we had as a society where we were all looking out for each other. This interview to me wasn't just tone deaf politically, tone deaf on a human level.
Now, some did back our man in Brussels for all kinds of reasons. Some human, we all make mistakes after all, and some more strategic, perhaps best summed up by this texter in Clare.
We have pragmatic listeners here, some pragmatic listeners, one of whom says we need a tough negotiator for Brexit. Phil Hogan would be our best bet. I write this through gritted teeth.
Gritted teeth it might be. However, as Alison O'Connor mentioned, it was the callers into Liveline who perhaps best reflected the anger and disappointment out there. On Monday, Orla phoned in to Katie Hannan.
I unfortunately lost my father to COVID on the early hours of Wednesday morning. And my poor mother is so distressed at not only the loss of her husband of 50 years, the love of her life, they were like peas in a pod, the two of them, but she's now coping with listening to the carry-on of those people in Clifton, and it's just so hard. She's already so much anger, and to listen to this from our leaders and our politicians is just salt in a wound that's already so raw.
And Orla talked about how the adherence to the COVID-19 restrictions had impacted on her family.
We were allowed up to the screen. My mother went in at one point and put on the full gear, but didn't want to touch him. And then up to that, we just went to the window pane and looked in at him. And that in itself is heartbreaking, because you want to hold his hand, you want to comfort him. And you can do nothing. And even we were at a point, because we were close contacts of Dad, that we couldn't comfort each other. And I don't think that's anything I'll ever forget, is watching my mother, my brother, my sister, all of us sobbing, but sobbing 2 metres apart. Oh, and that's how cruel this virus is. People need to understand how cruel it is to family life when it gets into it. And I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy.
Orla with Katie on Monday. And there were more stories from listeners who had lost loved ones to COVID-19 and the sacrifice they had made in obeying the public health guidelines. And their grief was matched with anger. Here's Sharon on Wednesday.
Yeah. All I basically want to say really is, if Mr. Hogan is listening into Liveline there, go, just go, because you don't represent me, my family, and you certainly don't represent my mum and dad who are in the nursing home. If he wants to do something, go down and look in the window at the heartache of these people in nursing homes and residential care homes and see the heartache. They can't do it. I can't go in when I feel like it to see my parents. I get a 1 half-hour visit a week. I look forward to it. It's heartbreaking when I leave and they're crying. They don't understand why I have to wear a mask. They don't understand why I can't go in and see them. And he goes and thinks he can do what he likes. He's an absolute disgrace. He's appalling behaviour. I just can't believe the arrogance of the man. Just go. We don't want you. Do the right thing and go.
Sharon on Wednesday reflecting many of the callers to Liveline this week. But it must be said, not all. Here's Cahill with the argument for keeping Phil Hogan in his place in Brussels.
So firstly, I think everyone has a right to be angry, upset, and every right to ask for Phil Hogan to resign. But I mean no disrespect by offering a different perspective as to whether he should resign or not, and this centres around the importance of the trade portfolio, especially this year. The Trade Commissioner is involved in extremely high-stakes negotiations with both our allies and hostile countries, involving tens and hundreds of billions of euro, And if Phil Hogan was chosen for this job out of 27 EU commissioners because he was believed to be the best candidate, and I don't imagine it's because he was particularly nice. And, you know, in 2017, he played a pivotal role in clinching a key trade deal between the EU and Japan, even before he was trade commissioner. And although this topic isn't particularly popular, these sorts of trade deals have a very large and positive effect on Irish lives and European lives.
Do you have a particular interest in this area, Col?
Yeah, huge interest. So I study economics and trade at the moment.
Right. And but you're not party affiliated or anything like that, are
no,
you?
No, I'm in no party.
Okay. So this is, you say, purely on the what Phil Hogan brings to that brief and how he can represent Irish interests in the job,
yeah,
he's in.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's no doubting the arrogance at which Irish people have been treated by some of our politicians. But your listeners shouldn't forget the ignorance and contempt showed towards Ireland by Boris Johnson's government in previous Brexit negotiations and also by the Trump administration in recent years. So, you know, Phil Hogan has been strong in talks with the UK, and his removal from office would be a great benefit to British government interests at the expense of our European interests.
So, like a particularly high-stakes game of chicken, all eyes were on Brussels and Ursula von der Leyen.
Will she sack, will she sanction, or will she save him?
Spin the bottle. Well, certainly former Fine Gael Minister for European Affairs Lucinda Creighton seemed to think Phil Hogan would survive. And not only that, we needed him to survive.
Is this trade portfolio and Phil Hogan in that portfolio, is it as important as we keep hearing?
It's hugely important. You know, I would argue not necessarily in the context of Brexit. I mean, I suppose from an Irish perspective, the unique kind of role of Ireland is kind of done and was done in phase one. And obviously Phil Hogan, as an Irish member of the commission, was very important in that part of the process. Now, you know, the future relationship is really being negotiated by Michel Barnier and his team. And it's very much a whole of EU and very much less focus on Ireland in terms of how those negotiations are being approached. But on the overarching role of Trade Commissioner, I mean, it is one of the most powerful and most important roles in the Commission. And there are tensions between member states. I mean, Ireland is one of the most pro-trade. We stand to benefit more from, you know, strong trading relationships with the United States, for example, and other third countries more than any other country. So it suits us very well to have a like-minded commissioner in that role. You know, Phil Hogan's appointment was not necessarily embraced by some countries, including, you know, bigger member states who might not be so enthusiastic about international trade as we are. So his role is really important, and having somebody in that role who has a similar mindset to Ireland and who kind of supports the Irish economic model is very important. And, you know, there's no guarantee that we would get that role again if there is to be a change.
Yeah,
and yet a change there was. Amidst an atmosphere of here's your hat, what's your hurry, by Wednesday night, it was all over. And on Thursday's News at One, Conor Kane spoke to people in Hogan's native Kilkenny to gauge their reaction to Big Phil's demise.
I think he left himself with no choice. Common sense should have taken care of all what he did. He walked into that room, he should have just turned on his heels and walked back. I think we miss more by Ireland going forward at the EU, because we've lost a big seat now in the EU.
He had to do it, but always a silly man. We needed him there, and it's completely the wrong time. But he had to go.
I think Phil is a big loss to Kilkenny and the country. I know that he broke the rules, and we can't dispute that, but there was a certain amount of shooting in the foot, but I suppose he had to go in the end. But he was a very good negotiator, a very larger than life individual, I suppose you could call him that.
If he'd come up straight up and said, I made a mistake, rather than trying to disguise it, he might still be there. But at this stage, it's a pity to see 40 years of a career going down like that.
And now the hunt is on for Phil Hogan's replacement, with Ursula von der Leyen looking for two candidates from Ireland, but no clear guarantee will hold the trade portfolio. But a clear message has been given that when it comes to COVID-19, those who make the rules must also obey them. And the fallout from Golfgate is not over yet, I'm afraid. Supreme Court Judge Seamus Wolfe, anyone? And we won't even mention our own Sean O'Rourke. Golf, a truly treacherous game. Welcome back. Now, you might be forgiven for thinking that the only sport-related story in town this week was golf-related, but not so. Another will-he-stay-or-will-he-go cliffhanger was that of footballer Lionel Messi. Yes, look at playback getting all sporty-sweaty. But even we know that the Barcelona player is a big deal. Fergal Brennan joined Marie and Dunica on 2FM's Game On to untangle it all. Now, Messi wants out of his club after 20 seasons, but it turns out not even mega footballers always get what they want.
The ball is now in the club's court. He has told the club his intention that he wants to leave, that he feels that his time is up. And obviously, we're aware that he has this clause in his contract, which is going to be a point of controversy in the coming weeks. That clause technically has expired. It lasts until the end of each season, which within itself, that the legal wording of it is quite vague, but he's essentially given a window at the end of each season to decide if he wants to continue. His point is that this season has been extended, so that clause should be extended into now. The club's argument is, well, that isn't written down in the detail, the small print of his contract. So this could get quite messy. That was an accidental pun, I promise, in the next few weeks, because the club don't have to sell him. This is something that I think has been missed in the last few hours. Barcelona are under no pressure necessarily, legally, to sell him unless it suits them.
But to keep their star player, Barcelona might need to compromise just a bit.
Fergal, what changes does he want?
I think it comes down to a club structure. I mean, there's obviously been a lot of focus on Josep Bartomeu, the club president, that is quite an unpopular figure with the fan base, and some of the decisions that he's made in the last few years have been very, very controversial. Sacking managers and promises over transfers coming back. Obviously, Neymar was the big one from last summer that didn't get over the line. But I think Messi's wider thing is a frustration that's been gathering over the last few years. Three back-to-back Champions League defeats that were all quite embarrassing, or comeback defeats. They let the La Liga title slip this season. It's the first year they haven't won a trophy for 12 seasons in a row. So I think what he's been seeing is that the frustration of promises were made from a team point of view, from managers, that the team would be able to perform better and certain issues wouldn't be the case. And he in his own mind has given the club the chance to rectify the Roma result from 3 years ago, the Liverpool result from last year, and they haven't done that, be that in transfers coming in or the makeup of the club. So I think his argument and his legal argument is, I've given my everything and the promises that were made to me behind the scenes haven't been kept to. So I think that's where he's actually garnering quite a bit of sympathy, because he's essentially saying, my hands are tied, I've done my best and I've been let down. What are the choices you're giving me?
Fergal Brennan as heard on Game On. But Barcelona are only dealing with one person, albeit a fairly big player in every sense of the word. Working in the HSC, on the other hand, not so easy. Former master of the National Maternity Hospital, Rona Mahoney, spoke to Des on the island about the decision-making processes in the HSC. And frankly, onions might have less layers.
I reported to a board. So we are a voluntary hospital, so we have a board, which I think is great. And I think every hospital should have a board, because it's checks and balances, it's strategic direction. And we have amazing people on our boards who have such skill set, and they give this completely pro bono. But then you would also report to the HSE. You'd also report to Ireland's healthcare group. You'd also report to the National Women and Infants Health Programme. You're also reporting to the Department of Health. And then there's the clinical care programmes within the HSE. It's a mess. So you have these layers of authority above the hospital. Some of them are authorised authority, some of them are unauthorised authority, but effectively trying to get a decision made is really difficult. And I think, to be fair, Paul Reid, who's come in as head of HSE, is doing a lot of work in terms of that sort of strategy piece. But we have a massive amount of work to do in streamlining our management structures, because otherwise your decision making is distorted and really compromised, and it just makes everyone's life more difficult.
Ooh, that does sound tricky. But despite all that, Rona Mahoney was optimistic, which led her quite nicely into her musical choice from Codaline.
So on the bad days, you'd be sitting there going, God, how are we going to get out of this? Or how am I going to manage this? Or, you know, and then you realise that bit by bit you will. It's all about motivation. And in High Hopes, in the chorus, it comes back all the time to back where we started from. And I have so high hopes. And I think that's the point, your motivation. You always have to come back. Why are you doing this? What is this all about? And that just nourishes you again. So even you're always going to get the knocks. You know, no one is going to take, and particularly not an Irish Irish healthcare, you're not going to walk in and wave a wand and everything's going to happen for you. You've got to be ready for those knocks and have that resilience. But I think if you have the motivation, then you have the courage to do the things you need to do and to make those difficult decisions. And then you do have to have hope. You know, I mean, it's a real essence of leadership is to either give people hope and to have hope, because that's what keeps you going. And I still love working in Irish healthcare. It's really complicated still, but you know, and you do get things done. And then there's a real sense of achievement. And I think as well, you know, the whole debate over the Eighth Amendment and to take part in that, you know what I mean, and to be able to advocate for patients, you know, and to see that change. These are really tangible, important things. And but you have to do the hard yards. There's no shortcuts in life, and that's number one.
Broken bottles in the hotel. It seems to me like I'm just scared of never feeling it again. But I know it's crazy to believe in silly things, but it's not that easy. I remember it now, it takes me back to when it all first started. But I've only got myself to blame for it. Accept it now. It's time to let it go. Go out and start again. But it's not that easy. But like a house, it takes me back to where we started.
Line, the choice of Rona Mahoney with Des, and a lovely welcome change for the ear from all the chatter. And you might need a clear head as well as perhaps a degree in physics to get to grips with the new Christopher Nolan film Tenet, which was up for review on Arena on Thursday night. Now Sean Rocks took a stab at describing it, and here he is with reviewers Michael Pope and Ro McDermott.
This is about preventing World War III through the use of time inversion. Please don't, well, maybe try to explain it to me really simply, Michael.
Well, I can't do that. I mean, I've seen this film twice. I went to cinema twice to see it, 5 hours of my precious life. And I could try to explain it, but also it is kind of better to not really give too much away in an initial review. It opens, or it begins or ends, depending how you want to see it, with this CIA agent. Who's called the protagonist? That's the only name we get from
played by John David Washington.
Yeah, Denzel Washington's son. He's on this undercover operation in to steal an object from this terrorist siege in this Kiev opera house. It's actually a pretty good sequence to open up with. He's captured and tortured, and he takes a suicide pill before he gives away any information. But the pill is a fake. It's a test of his loyalty and his integrity. And now he's been recruited into this top secret mission and given only the word.
Don't be sweet. I'm going to get have his recruitment.
This is in the trailer. That is about as much as he'll give away.
My head's a bit sore. Sounds tricky. Did Ro agree?
The plot is the most inaccessible that we've seen in one of his films, and deliberately so, because we see the protagonist open up. This is absolutely spoiler free, but he meets some things that have been in the trailer, but he meets someone who introduces the idea of something called inverted time and also introduces us to Nolan's get out clause regarding his theory of time in the film, which is don't try to understand it. And there is several plots going on, some of which tie together, some of which feel like very big and very long distractions. But it feels like Christopher Nolan has created a film that is deliberately obtuse, and deliberately you have to go back, as Michael did. I didn't go back to see it a second time
well,
yet.
Well, let's
you
ask.
You have to go back to understand it, which feels slightly cynical.
Down to brass tacks then. Stars out of 5?
I'm going to give it a 3. I think it is a film that is really enjoyable to see on the big screen because the action sequences are incredibly impressive, even if sometimes they have very little to do with the plot. But I just think it's lacking kind of the emotion and the comprehensibility that we need for a Nolan film.
Ouchie. Michael?
Well, if I can give it out of 10 because I saw it twice, I'm going to give it 4 out of 10.
So 2 out of 5.
2 for each viewing. That's not great going, is it? No.
Michael Pope and Roe McDermott not exactly falling over themselves to give stars to Tenet by Christopher Nolan, as heard on Thursday night's Arena. On Tuesday, Ray Darcy got all misty-eyed with Colm O'Regan about ye olde roadside petrol stations.
You know, you drive into a petrol station and a young lad would almost uncoil himself from a wall. You didn't see him. Like somebody, a young lad would suddenly appear at the window and, you know, you'd hand him the 20,
yeah, well, I fill
20
it up,
pound
yeah.
note. And fill it up, yeah. The world's most boring job, but still a job nonetheless. So it's kind of... yeah, you
I'd forgotten
you
about
there's
that.
There's still a few of them around.
There was no need for you to get out of the car. You could
exactly,
just, yeah. I'd forgotten all about
whereas
that.
Now, social interaction is sort of, you know, where you can fill up automatically at the petrol pump and you put in the amount and then, like, the petrol races in and then it slows to an absolute, you know, nap.
Oh, because you've paid the 50 euro or whatever. Yes, yes, yeah.
And you certainly wouldn't want to be on the run from lockdown or anything, trying to get away from petrol. You'd probably give back the euro spare at the end. Or, sometimes you go in to pay for petrol and somebody will try and interest you in a special chocolate offer. You want these four double-deckers for 2 euro, which I think is a great idea.
Don't slag off the double-decker.
The double-decker is the most underrated of bars.
Look, we chatted about this because it kept me, the double-decker kept me awake over all those years driving around the country going to discos here and discos there. And you'd be driving back at 2 o'clock in the morning or 2:30 and you'd stop and you'd get a can of Coke and a double-decker and it sets you up then you're fine to get back to Dublin without falling asleep.
That's
at the wheel.
Right, yeah.
And kids, if you're listening, that is a perfectly balanced meal, honestly. Go on, ask for tonight. But back to Ray Darcy, who sent us all scurrying to the Google machine with this anecdote.
Just for your entertainment, I starred in a short film which was set in a forecourt.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I think that's what it's called. Is it forecourt.
Are you happy to... All right. Is it available online?
I don't know. I don't know why I've said that. I think it's first day back from holidays feeling enthusiastic and honest. No, I actually shouldn't have said that out loud.
Is this the misstep that gets you...
No.
Is this your Clifton...
No, it's not. No, it's not. It's not. It's all above board. I play the love interest of the young girl who works the petrol pump. Not even the love interest. She's infatuated. Odd, very. Anyway, there, it's out there. I shouldn't have even said that. Anyway, Colm O'Regan, good luck. No, don't go.
I'm not going to Google straight away. I'll give it 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Colm O'Regan with Ray Darcy. Back in a bit. Welcome back.
At no time before have voters faced a clearer choice between two parties, two visions, two philosophies, or two agendas. This election will decide whether we save the American dream or whether we allow a socialist agenda to demolish our cherished destiny.
It's official. Not that there was much doubt, but Donald Trump is the Republican candidate for President of the United States. Bob Schmuel, Emeritus Professor of American Studies at the University of Notre Dame, spoke to Justin McCarthy on the News at One yesterday. And no one, it seems, is going to play nice in this one.
It will be interesting to see the real response to the president's speech last night. It was from the White House. It went 70 minutes, whereas Joe Biden's speech went for 25 minutes during his convention. But what I would point out, Justin, is that Donald Trump attacked Joe Biden 41 times during the speech last night. That just suggests how dirty and personal this campaign could get over the next 67
days.
I
was just going to ask you that because it does have all the hallmarks of being one of the ugliest, dirtiest presidential election campaigns ever, doesn't it?
It does. And... I would argue that that will be important to the final perception of people. What do I mean by that? We already know that Donald Trump is really by nature a street fighter. Every day of the campaign in 2016, every day of his presidency has been pretty much a battle. While Joe Biden is perceived as sort of this decent statesmanlike figure and someone that they've known for over 40 years, really, in national politics in this country. And I think the judgment will be important. Do people want to continue to see the fighting, or do they want to try to slow things down and move forward in a different way?
Bob Schmuel on yesterday's News at One on the skin and hair that may fly as we head into that US November election. Well, someone talking more love than hate was Auschwitz survivor and psychologist Edith Eger, who's just published her book, The Gift, 12 Lessons to Save Your Life. She talked to Brendan O'Connor, and for her, love was demonstrated not in the telling, but in the doing.
I think love is not what you feel, it's what you do.
Yeah.
And none of the positive thinking does any good, I keep telling people, unless it's followed with a positive action. My definition of love is the ability to let go. Let go of the need for approval of others. If you see something needs to be done, just do it. And I think it's very important to have cooperation and work as a team. And that's what we had to do in Auschwitz. We had to create a family of inmates. If you were just thinking about you, you didn't make it.
And as a practicing psychologist, Edith Eger had some thoughts about relationships. And as it turned out, Brendan O'Connor had a few questions.
And Edith, what do you think the secret is that if the passion is gone out of a relationship, what would be your tips for rejuvenating the relationship, rejuvenating the sex life?
I think one of the things I usually ask couples, don't ask how are you and don't say why don't you, because that's what parents do. They ask questions and they give advice. And it's better to say, gee, it's good to see you, I miss you, I hope you had a good day. That I like sentences, and don't say yes, but. You know, don't tell your little girl that you're very pretty, but I want you to really wear different clothes, and I want you to lose weight. And, you know, the butt will cancel everything what you said before the butt. So give me the butt, and I give you an end. I pay attention what you're paying attention to. Any behavior you pay attention to, you reinforce that behavior. So that's why when you marry the hot lover, you really don't know each other because you're in love with love. And falling in love is a chemical high that people get from chocolate. So don't marry the hot lover, marry your soulmate.
But even soulmates need to make the effort.
Sensuality is very different than sexy. You know, it's sometimes when we're married, we do things routinely.
And we stop and, making
you know,
the effort.
You walk around in your underwear and you don't look very delicious. Tell your wife also how you would like to have a love affair and you want to have it with her. And don't talk about your work and don't talk about your children. And don't talk about anyone who's not there, because that's gossip.
Edith, I'm going to come away from this encounter a better husband and a better father and a better man, I think.
Positively life-changing stuff there from Edith Eger with the rather smitten Brendan O'Connor. The bar is set fierce high for radio, I tell you. Now, much of the airtime this week was devoted to Back to School, a staple of the calendar, but this was not like any return we'd known before. Many parents, teachers and pupils had very real concerns over how the return to school would work. On Thursday, Claire Byrne spoke to WHO Special Envoy on COVID-19, David Nabarro, about the WHO's recommendation that children over 6 should wear masks on a risk-based approach.
Fundamentally, we have to see children as actually similar to adults in most ways when it comes to reducing risk of COVID. So that does mean we ask children to adopt the universal precautions that we're asking adults to adopt, particularly at this time, trying to keep the numbers down as low as possible in every part of the world. And that means children over 12 asked to do exactly what adults are doing. Now, younger children between 6 and 11 are actually still to be considered in the same bracket. After all, they can get the virus, they can transmit the virus, they may well be able to bring the virus into the home to infect other people. But at the same time, asking children between 6 and 11 to adopt a physical distancing and to wear face protection is sometimes a bit much. And that's why the recommendations were very much asking teachers and parents to work through with the children and see what's possible, with the additional caveat that if there's a lot of virus circulating in the community, it is right to ask the children to be extra careful.
Dr. David Nabarro of the WHO. And yesterday on Morning Ireland, Brian Dobson put this scenario to Dr. Colm Henry, Chief Clinical Officer of the HSE.
What happens in a school if a child tests positive for the virus? Will all of their classmates be tested, teachers who have contact with them? What's the protocol, the procedures in that sort of situation?
Just briefly, first, I could see that the emerging evidence is more reassuring about schools. First, we know that most cases in children mild or asymptomatic, only 5% of cases, even though children comprise 25% of the population, less than 18, only 5% of cases, according to ECDC, are in children. And we know that child-to-child transmission is unusual in school settings.
Yeah.
In the event that what you describe is public health departments will go in, each individual school setting is different. They'll analyse the layout of the school, the number of close contacts, how the school is behaving and adhering to infection prevention control. And I would just like to acknowledge the huge work done by principals and teams.
So there isn't a template, really, is what you're saying.
There is a set of principles applied, which allows identification of close contacts and testing, which is different in every school and educational setting.
Dr. Colm Henry of the HSE on Morning Ireland yesterday. So how are schools approaching all of this, particularly when resources and buildings vary in scale and quality? Well, one principal and teacher, Martha Wilmington, at Hoth Road Primary School in Clontarf, was taking the little red hen approach to restructuring the COVID classroom. Here she is talking to Ryan.
I was up in IKEA. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that.
Yeah, of course you are. Go on, you're in IKEA.
I was up in IKEA last week and... honestly, Ryan, you could play spot the teacher. You know, the teachers were the people going past you with a stack of 30 tubs all the same so they can divide everything up for every child in their class. And then they have their friend or their sister or their brother or whoever else they can bring in close contact with them pushing the second trolley with all the trays for sorting stuff. And it was hysterical. And I was like, teacher, teacher, teacher.
And is that, out of curiosity, Martha, is that the teacher's job or the department's job to supply, for example, 30 separate Tupperware boxes from IKEA? I'm not trying to stir a row up. I'm just curious.
It's a very good question. I mean, this year we've been given COVID funding to make it possible to reorganise and restructure the way we do school. And different schools are going to do that in different ways, depending on their context. I can only speak for my own.
Yeah.
But, you know, so in my classroom, I'm teaching infants, so I have a lot of sensory activities, you know, sand, Play-Doh, all those kind of things. Obviously, I can't be passing those pupil to pupil, but I can use them in pods now and things like that. So I'm having to multiply up the number of trays I have for everything. So is it technically my job to go off to IKEA? Probably not. But if I don't do it, no one's going to do it. You know, it has to be done.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, someone's got to do it. So,
yeah.
And Martha was taking an equally up and at 'em approach to bringing a friendlier face to the signage around all the new rules.
Instead of yellow and black dotted lines on the yard, we've gone for smiley faces. We've actually colour coded by the classrooms because each of our classrooms has a colour. So the spots on the yard to help them line up when they arrive at school will be matching their doors just to help them find their own way in because they're all coming in new doors and things like that. So, you know, we've done, we think, as much as we can to help ease it without it feeling stressful. So we've gone for colourful primary shapes that are natural in a primary school that we're teaching the names of day to day anyway out on the yard. So that's kind of the small steps we're taking to try and make it friendly and not off-putting, because school is meant to be a welcoming and warm and safe space. It has always been meant to be a safe space where children can go and be a haven from, you know, as much as home is, it needs to be a haven where children can learn safely. COVID is just yet another challenge, but it doesn't mean that we lose sight of all that our ethos statements have always said, that we need to have warm, caring environments that support learning, not detract from it and say, yes, you could do that, but no, we're not doing that now because we've got COVID-19 to do it. So we're trying to keep the focus on the learning and the fun and the the experience rather than on all the rules and regulations. So it's kind of making those part and parcel of what we do.
Primary school principal and teacher Martha Wilmington with Ryan on Tuesday. But one possibly unforeseen hazard was hand sanitizer.
Parents have been warned not to send their children to primary school with alcohol-based hand sanitizers. Well, in a starkly worded alert, the National Poisons Information Centre said it would amount to sending a child to school with a naggin of vodka. Is it really that? Has the situation got that bad? That no, surely. This place, they're based in Beaumont Hospital, and said that a 100ml bottle of 80% alcohol hand sanitizer contains the same amount of alcohol as a 200ml bottle of 40% vodka. So they're saying be careful. I think people are probably just so up to the nines getting their act together that checking the alcohol levels on the hand sanitizer mightn't be their number one priority. But it's a word of warning, so there it is.
Obviously not to be used to take the edge off double mats. And the award for cutest report of the week might well go to Drive Time's John Cook. He visited Glenroo National School in Limerick in the foothills of the Galty Mountains. And this is very sweet indeed.
What are we doing inside?
We're doing a dance. Clap it out.
Clap it out. Will we all do it? And what should we do when we just came out the door there?
Hand sanitizer.
Clean those hands. Very important, isn't it?
Yeah.
Who wants to say hello for the radio?
Me.
Okay.
I'm Rebecca and my age is 7.
Tell me about school. What was the best thing today?
Playing with the Play-Doh.
Yeah.
Danny, there's a wasp on you.
Don't mind the wasp. At least the sun has come out again and the rain has stopped.
It's back. It's on your shoe. Hola, and I'm 5. And I'm in seniors.
Tell me your name, your age.
Anya.
And how old are you?
5.
You're twins. Is it any wonder I thought I was seeing double? And you've had each other to play with at home for all the lockdown, haven't you? But is it nice to be in school with other people today?
Yeah. Look at the wasp keep.
Is the wasp at you again?
Yeah.
Okay, shoo him away.
There's two of them. I'm in first class.
And how old are you, Molly?
6.
My name is Danny. I'm 10 and I'm in fifth class. The only person in fifth class. Yeah, I went to a way bigger school before.
What's it like coming to a school this small?
Quiet. It's fun. I'm good at PE and art.
Looking forward to getting outside a lot so and playing here.
Yeah.
Are you all happy to be back at school?
Yeah! John Cook at Glenroo National School as heard on Drive Time. So sweet, I might have lost a tooth. Well, that is it for this week's playback. Thank you for listening. And let's finish with something that's childlike but also slightly creepy. Talk to you next week.
Tiptoe through the window, by the window, that is where I'll be. Come tiptoe through the tulips with me.
Tiptoe through the tulips.